The title of the book is Foreground Music, A Life in 15 Gigs. And the idea of foreground music then, as opposed to background music.
Yeah, I was definitely aware that most writing about music tends to be about studio recordings, tends to be, you know, your top 50 albums, best studio, all that. And I don't know, I just sort of thought there's something so special about a good gig. And it is that thing, I think, as well about something happening in the moment. And
yeah.
It could be different tomorrow night and it could go wrong. And I think that energy is quite sort of enticing. And particularly when you're young and you first start going to gigs, I think you sort of like, that energy is so vital and so energising for yourself. So, yeah, I think because a lot of time when we're experiencing music, it is background music, you know, it's, whether it's on film or TV or, you know, you're in a bar, restaurant, the gym, you know, you can listen to music all the time and it's great. It sort of enhances life, but it's not the focus. Whereas it's anybody gigs, you know, and to a certain degree clubbing where the music becomes the absolute focus of the evening. So I sort of wanted to write about that, really.
So these are 15 gigs over the course of your life, which kind of have some landmark qualities, I suppose. But let's go right back, because your very first gig was an international superstar, which you do admit to in the book.
Yeah.
But possibly slightly embarrassing.
Well, yeah, a lot of people will try and tell, oh, yeah, my first gig was, you know, whatever, the Foo Fighters or the Clash. Or the Clash was actually my third gig. But no, my first gig was Cliff Richard. It wasn't my idea, I'll say that much. But my elder sister, Carolyn, was a massive Cliff fan, and she was only seven, and some of my gran had got these tickets to this Cliff Richard concert, and so, you know, me and my gran and my mum and Carolyn went, and we thought it was going to be just a normal Cliff Richard concert, but it wasn't. It was a gospel concert. He didn't sing any hits. He just sang lots and lots of dirges about Jesus, and I went along thinking, because I just wasn't interested in music. That's the weird thing. Now, for what a massive part it's played in my life, I really wasn't interested in music. Somehow I wasn't aware of things like T-Rex and Bowie and stuff, and all the cool stuff that was around when I was a kid. I was just aware of, like, Alvin Stardust and people like that, you know, the Osmonds and stuff. I just thought it was rubbish. So I thought, and I said it to myself many times, people who like music are stupid. Why would you bother? And by the time I went to see Cliff Richard, I'd discovered James Bond and James Bond soundtrack. So that was my big passion. So Cliff was already quite weedy in comparison to that. But I went there thinking, where's Cliff Richard? And he was, you know, this was 1974. He was massive. I mean, he's still a big star.
Yeah.
But then, you know, he was just everywhere. He was on TV. He had his own sort of Saturday night show, like the Morecambe Wise type shot on BBC. 4 years of that. He was on everybody. He was just inescapable. And being a kid, you know, 10, and you're seeing this star, you know, and we were quite close to the stage, I was impressed. I wasn't entertained, but I was impressed, you know. So it was a very gentle introduction to the world of music,
live music. Well, as you've intimated there, you had the misfortune to be born slightly too late to, you know, to get the best of glam rock as a kid, and also to be in that first flush of punk. But punk, of course, seeped into your life, as would be inevitable.
Yeah, I think for me, like early on, my understanding of punk was just basically what was in the tabloids, because it wasn't really on TV, you know, and I wasn't hip to Peel at that stage, to the John Peel show. So yeah, it was very early 78, basically. I my friend Pete, my best friend, was into the Stranglers, and I thought, oh, the Stranglers were okay, but it didn't really do much for me. And then he played me a Buzzcocks single, What Do I Get, which was, I think, February 1978, and that was like a real epiphany. I was thinking, wow, this is, I don't know, because the Stranglers seemed, I didn't like their attitude, they seemed like bullies somehow, whereas the Buzzcocks, it just seemed really something else completely, and it seemed really modern. That was a thing.
And short and snappy. Say what you've got to say in 2 minutes,
yeah,
and then
exactly,
clear off again.
Exactly, and it just seemed like really short, really vital, and although I didn't realise it at the time, I think the mix of sexuality in it, where it wasn't particularly heterosexual or homosexual, it was just very human and very, you know, about the soul somehow, without being soul music. So I don't know, it just instantly grabbed me, and then I just wanted to find out anything I could about the Buzzcocks, and through that got into listening to John Peel and found out, you know, more stuff. But yeah, I wasn't an early convert to punk. I didn't resist it, I just wasn't really aware of it, I suppose. And then suddenly I sort of just thought, right, I get it now.
So the Jam feature very early on in your book.
Yes, so that was the first sort of rock gig I went to, which was, so I'd been, as they say, into punk for about 4 or 5 months, but I'd never actually been to a gig. And, you know, we were 14, so you need your pocket money, really. So you were saving up to buy singles and albums, you know, like kids all across the country. And then my mate Pete phoned up and he said, I've just won tickets to see The Jam tonight. Do you want to come? I said, yeah, of course. It was a rites of passage, you know. And it's like Cliff had been 4 years earlier. But that had been just a very gentle sort of evening, whereas this, the volume was just amazing. And that, you know, being able to feel music in your chest, yeah, yeah, and in your body, you know. And I think the first time you experienced that, it's... there's something alchemical about it. You say, well, that, you know, I'm used to listening to music with my ears, but now it's like taking over my whole being, you know. So, yeah, it was incredibly exciting, but I got overexcited, basically, and decided I wanted to put my head right up against the speaker bins down at the front of the stage, because I just thought, this is overpowering, I want to hear it in detail. And I got just the most horrific tinnitus, which lasted for the best part of a week.
I think we've all been there.
Yeah, but this was, you know, like I said, I was 14 and I was at my parents' house and I was just walking into the kitchen. Suddenly the tinnitus got so loud and I just blacked out and it was like overpowering, you know. And then it sort of, when I came round and it sort of went back to normal, really. My mum said, ooh, I don't think you should go to any more of those shows. And I was going, yeah, maybe not, you know. But in my mind thinking, I can't wait to get back. And then The Clash played in Blackburn about 3 weeks later, so that was it. After that, there was no stopping me, you know. Me and my mate Pete just said, right, let's go to every punk band that plays in Blackburn, which wasn't that many, you know. We're talking about 3 or 4 a year, probably. Uh-huh. So we soon started going to Manchester and further afield to catch stuff, because it just became an absolute addiction.
So let's have one of your live jam tracks, okay, then. So I've got Mr. Clean, which was recorded on the 1979 tour.
Yes, yeah, so this is a little bit after I saw them, but it's you can really get the energy and the sort of the verve of this.
Mr. Clean, a piece of toast from the one you love most, and you leave. Get your bus in the 8 o'clock rush and catch your train in the morning rain, Mr. I don't ever want to catch you looking at me, Mr. Clean. I hate you and your wife, and if I get the chance, I'll back up your life, Mr. Clean. Mr. Clean. Is that sea? Yourself with dreams of pretty young girls and anyone you want, but please don't forget me or any of my kind, 'cause we'll make you think again when I stick your face in the grind. As you came, Buster,
guitar.
Yeah, I mean, you really get the sense of energy for that. It's obviously yeah. it's a down tempo song, but you know the fire and the anger and the energy is, yeah. is really right yeah. on it.
And he's got that, you know, his we sort of got used to it now. But that guitar playing style is quite unique, really, or certainly was at the time. And it is, it's not quite lead playing, it's not quite rhythm playing, you know. And it's a trite thing to say, but the Jam never sounds like just three people. It's like
absolutely,
there's something
yeah.
else
yeah, yeah.
happens there,
yeah.
there, you know. And I just love how full of bile he sounds as well.
Yeah.
You know, he's like class is the ultimate divider, and you know, if I get the chance, I'll fuck up your life. Am I allowed to say that?
You just did.
You just did, didn't I? And I remember at the gig when he sang that, and loads of people just cheering and looking around and thinking, that's because they're all school kids, you know. And so somebody shouted, you know, profanity was just like exciting and dangerous in its own right, you know. But, yeah, I'm not like the world's biggest Jam fan by any means, but I think at that point what they were doing was very exciting, and they had a lot to prove, I think.
Yeah.
And then they proved it. And also it's that thing of, you know, they were sort of birthed or came to prominence during punk, but they weren't a punk band.
No, absolutely not. Right place at the right time,
yeah,
though. Yeah,
exactly. But it's like they benefited from an audience that wanted a stripped-back, you know, sound. And, yeah, I think the stuff from that era stands up remarkably well, actually.
Now, you had the good fortune to be up north at the time, and the incredible bands that you had access to, like heading off to Manchester, and you had Joy Division and The Fall.
Yeah, it's one of those things where sometimes you look back in your life and you sort of think, oh, I was lucky and I didn't realise. Whereas I think at the time I did realise how lucky I was, because there was so many of the bands that I was getting excited about. You think, oh, they're doing a gig and it's only 20 miles away. But I saw so many sort of crucial bands early on. And, you know, I look back now and think, my mum and dad were just letting, you know, age 14, letting me travel, like, to Manchester, which is a good
but
hour
that's
or
what
so
people
away.
Used to do in those days.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going off to gigs at age 15, which, you know, you didn't have to show any idea or anything like that
know,
in those
yeah.
days. And you could just hang out at the bar and nobody cared.
Yeah, I know, it's weird, isn't it? Because I remember thinking, like, you know, one time I was supposed to be meeting somebody and I went to a pub, and I think I was 16 at the time, and they said, sorry, mate, you can't come in here. And I thought, oh, yeah, of course I can't, because I was so used to going to nightclubs and concert halls yeah. where there'd be about, and nobody questioned it, you know, and there was people far younger than me going in. So, yeah, you just had that freedom. But I went to Manchester regularly and, you know, saw The Fall and Joy Division and Buzzcocks magazine. Buzzcocks came to play in Blackburn several times, and they always brought like a really good support band with them. So I saw like Ludus,
yeah.
Joy Division, various other ones really early on, you know. And yeah, I was aware, I think, I was aware that I was in the middle of something exciting, you know. And Manchester certainly wasn't the only place, but, you know, it was one of the key places, I suppose, along with Leeds and Sheffield,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, and London, obviously. But
sure.
yeah, no, I did feel very fortunate.
And Joy Division burned brightly, but for such a short space of time, absolutely phenomenal.
Yes, yeah.
Live, quite ramshackle, but that had a whole energy of its own to it.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I saw them, which was supporting the Buzzcocks, it was incredibly tight, and I don't know, whoever was doing the mixing was really on it. It wasn't the sort of the smoothness and the nuance of the records, but it was really sort of tight and organised. And then the second time I saw them at Preston, there was loads of equipment failure and things just went wrong, and it, you know, I felt quite disappointed. And they seemed quite angry about it, but that somehow led to like a real intensity to what they were doing. So yeah, so that was good. And I think the thing is as well, it's like, because a lot of that recorded stuff is not measured, but there's a sort of, you know, it's sort of contained. And live they were much more aggressive and much more sort of defiant, you know, if you like.
So you picked a track from Preston, 28th of February 1980.
Yes, I was at this gig.
You were there.
This was my
there.
Second gig. And this is The Eternal, which is quite possibly my favourite Joy Division song.
have to just wait a minute while we go with the bass guitar. I too apologize. Everything.
Interesting choice there, that Joy Division track, because it's not one of their more upbeat numbers. It's a bold choice for them to play in a live set as well.
Yeah, I mean, this was during the gig where, you know, equipment was failing. They were asking the audience for requests and stuff. But yeah, I mean, it is, and as we were saying when it was playing, it's a little bit prog as well, you know, for the time. It's quite bold in that respect, because there's no trace of punk or even new wave there, is there? It's something quite of itself. But they were, I think they were just an incredibly exciting live band, and the energy of punk was still in some of what they were doing, I think, you know, and it's
sure.
just, yeah. But that is my favourite Joy Division song, because I think it is so genuinely touching, and also in some of the lyrics you just think you can see him giving voice to, you know, his struggles, as it were, without wanting to sort of mythologise and turn him into this tragic poet, you know, which people are very keen to do. But somebody said to me a while ago, they said, oh, what was the news reporting like when Ian Curtis died? I said, well, it wasn't like that. It wasn't that big mythic thing that it's become. I said, it was in the NME and Sounds, and that was it.
When John Peel announced it.
Yeah, John Peel announced it. But you know, it wasn't, they were sort of thinking it'd be on the national news or something.
Said, no, not at all.
It's become this thing, but it wasn't that at the time, you know.
And talking to Graham Duff about his new book, Foreground Music, A Life in 15 Gigs. Graham, there is a slightly Trainspotter-ish element to your book, I have to say, because I was reading the Joy Division section. Yeah. You're talking about Section 25. And I thought, when are Crispy Ambulance going to make an appearance then? And I turned the page, lo and behold, there is Crispy Ambulance.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly a band better forgotten. It's very detailed in what you write about.
Yeah, well, I think I do have all that knowledge stored away. So, well, here's a chance to actually turn it to some good use, I suppose. And also, what I realised as I started writing the book is that I have got a really good memory, you know, and I'd be talking to people, oh, do you remember when you did? And people go, no. And I go, no, you did, because you were wearing that. And I go, was I? And I go, yeah, you know, because you just split up with your girlfriend. And I think because, you know, my day job, if you like, is as a script writer, so I've sort of probably trained myself to remember turns of phrase and the way people speak, and, you know, because you can't always write it down. And people are always saying funny things, and I thought, they're never going to say that again. They're going to have forgotten the set. I can use that, and that's one I don't have to think up myself, you know, to put in a script. So I think I do have an eye for detail. I mean, hopefully I balance it in the book so it doesn't just feel like somebody reeling off a bunch of train numbers, you know.
But you mentioned there that you're a scriptwriter and you're an actor as well. Mm. And in tandem with your love of music and these 15 gigs, you do talk about the development of your writing career. What got you started off? What was your first lucky break?
You know, there's a lot of kids want to be astronauts. When I was 11, I thought I want to write for television, and I told my mum that, and that's, you know, primarily I wanted to write Doctor Who. That was my big passion, you know. My big break. What was my big break? I think my career sort of happened in increments, really. I suppose the first thing I got that was like national, I suppose, was Loose Ends on Radio 4. Uh-huh. I did a column on that called the Duff Almanac, which was just like a daft almanac of things, you know, celebratory thing. And during that time, I was touring quite a lot. I was in a double act with a guy called James Poulter, and we did a lot of gigs. And then I started doing a solo thing as well. And that, incidentally, was about music. That was about music obsessives. I did it live, and then that got turned into a radio show for Radio 4. So that was, I suppose, my first big break. That would 1998, so just over 20 years ago now. So that was my first big break, I suppose, in real terms. I suppose what I've always done in terms of writing and trying to get things made, there's a brilliant quote by J.G. Ballard where he says, my advice to anybody in any field would be just follow your obsessions and let them guide you like a sleepwalker. And I think that's it, because if I'm writing about things I'm obsessed by, I know whether or not I'm hitting the mark, because I think, oh, right, there's enough information or not enough. Or whereas if it's something I'm not interested in, you know, I'm not passionate about, I don't know if I'm doing it right.
Yeah.
So everything I've done has sort of reflected some of my passions, whether it's music or horror films or whatever, you know. So, yeah, but music always has, I've managed to fold that in, and, you know, with like things like the series Ideal I did, you know, sort of choosing all the soundtrack music, and managing to get stuff on TV you wouldn't, you know, like Throbbing Gristles, Sleater-Kinney, stuff that isn't necessarily at the top of people's lists when they're looking for, you know, soundtracks for TV. Because that is one of the things that really winds me up. I watch programmes that I really enjoy, and then some of the music cues, I think, oh, God, that's so obvious, so, you know. Or stuff that has too much baggage. stuff that you sort of think, that's a great track, but just remind, it's been used in other films, it's been used in advert, you know, whereas I like things that just have their own resonance, you know. It doesn't have to be ultra obscure, but just stuff that's not carrying lots of baggage for the audience.
Yeah, yeah. There is a bit of a theme as well, which runs through this book and your work.
Yeah.
And that's, you do admit to fairly copious amounts of enthusiastic drug taking in the book. And obviously you've got the Ideal series, the TV yeah. series with Johnny Vegas, which is about a rather lame drug dealer.
Yeah.
And you cause a degree of controversy when you did the A to Z of Drugs
yeah.
stage show as well.
Yeah, so that's that with James Paltrow I mentioned earlier. We'd been at college together and we did a show called the A to Z of Drugs where we travelled around with a suitcase full of legal highs, basically, and tested them out on audiences and stuff. We weren't really doing it with a sort of sensationalist head on, you know.
Yeah.
We weren't thinking, oh, this'll cause controversy. We just thought it'd be interesting, and it was something we were interested in. This was mid-90s, and it was time when legal highs were starting to appear, and there was a sort of acknowledgement that, you know, drug taking did go on, so maybe there was a healthier way to do it, you know, and it sort of got a bit muddy in the end. But it was a weird experience because we did about 300 gigs.
Uh-huh.
You know, we travelled over a couple of years and we did like a big residency in Australia and we travelled around Ireland and all around the UK. And it just got to the point where we were doing interviews and a lot of the interviews were about the legality or the morality rather than about how funny it was.
Right, okay,
so, you
yeah.
know, and then we got interviewed by the police and we appeared in Crown Court in Lewis over. It was just, it was insane really. And it was just this little idea. We thought, oh, this would be interesting, this would be funny. And it just became this other thing. So, I mean, with regard to the book, with foreground music, there is quite a lot.
Did you think twice about putting all that in?
No, there's stuff I thought twice about and took out. I mean, the stuff I didn't put in. I mean, God knows what my mum's going to think when she reads it. You know, I think
she's not read it yet.
No,
okay,
I think she's got her suspicions,
yeah.
but I think she's.
So Graham, you're a very naughty boy.
Oh,
I didn't know all that about you.
It's just some of the early drug that I think she's going to retrospectively be worried for, like the 14-year-old me. You know. But then again, that is a big part of people's experience of live music as well, isn't it? You know, and as we all know, a lot of the musicians are doing the same thing. It doesn't mean you can't enjoy it without that. It doesn't mean that that's an essential part of the experience. But there's like the chapter where me and my friend Malcolm go and see the Shaman, as like early on in their career. You know, and we'd go there at the Zap Club, we go down to the beach and we do a couple of big pipes for hash before we go inside. That's not a big deal, really, you know. But I just thought, well, if I don't put that in, that's not really admitting what I was like at the time. You
yeah.
know? And I also had quite long dreadlocks at the time.
Oof, that is an admission.
I know, particularly for a man who is completely bald now.
Fine. Now, as you mentioned there, you were in Brighton. You moved down to Brighton from up north
yeah.
To study, and you're one of these people who's come to Brighton, loved it and stayed here.
Yes, somebody once said to me, I wasn't born here, but I was born to be here. And that is part, I think, of the way I feel about Brighton.
Yeah. Just,
I think once you've lived in Brighton, it is quite hard to be satisfied with anywhere else. And when I first came, I came here in 82, and it wasn't really on the gig circuit in the way it is now.
Uh-huh.
And also, it wasn't, you know, Brighton's hip and has been hip for quite a long time, but it wasn't in the early 80s.
It was scuzzy.
Yeah, it was scuzzy, and it was seen as being sort of analogous with like Blackpool or Southport. It was like, it was fun, but it wasn't cool. There was no way it was cool. You know, and a lot of the Brighton bands weren't cool bands.
Oh, yeah.
They were
yeah.
sort of novelty bands. You know, not that there isn't a place for that, but it wasn't Manchester, it wasn't Sheffield, it wasn't even Glasgow, you know. It was Brighton and it was sort of all right. And then, well, certain things happened, didn't they? I think in club culture, it's always been big for hip-hop, you know, in Brighton, which is good. And then the big beat thing, you know, whatever you think about that. But it sort of vitalised Brighton. And I think in the last sort of 30 years, there's been various points where Brighton has just been, you know, the right chemistry has happened, and it's you know, and also we've produced some really good bands. We, as if I've got anything to do with it. Brighton has produced some really good bands, you know, in the last 20 years or so.
Absolutely, but surprisingly few who really, really hit the big time.
Yeah, yeah.
Surprisingly few, when you count the thousands of bands that there are here.
Yeah, I know, and that's the thing that, you know, you can.
It's because we're all a bunch of slackers down here.
Well, I remember Bobby Gillespie saying that living in Brighton.
Name dropping.
He didn't say it to me in an interview, so I don't know him. But I remember him saying, you know, the thing about Brighton is just easy just to chill out. And, you know, that you talk about projects more than you do them. And I thought, yeah, I can see that. I've always been really driven, and I, you know, I I enjoy writing more than pretty much anything else. But I can see, you know, if you, it is easy just to chill out and just, you know, cafe culture and all that. And what you do tend to get, I think, with a lot of Brighton bands is they got a lot of promise to do a brilliant first album, and then they just dick about for a while, you know, and don't quite get around to fulfilling their promise.
And yeah. Talking about a band that did many, many albums and split up and came back again.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always very chary of going to see bands that did great things in the past.
Good word, chary.
Yeah. Did good things in the past, and then, you know, they come back and they're cashing in, ka-ching, because there's an audience for it. But you actually went to see the reformed Velvet Underground with varying results.
I did. Well, they were on at Glastonbury, so, and I was performing there, so I was sort of going anyway. But I have to say, when I saw the Velvet Underground's name on this, I thought, oh, great, because like a lot of people, you know, the Velvet Underground just mean an awful lot to me. And then there's a discography in the book, and I talk about that first Velvet song, just saying, like, basically, this is one of the most important musical recordings of the 20th century period. You know, you can't really argue with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that thing of, like, if you try and imagine the landscape of contemporary music without the influence of the Velvet Underground, it is impossible,
yeah.
Because it's like, you think, all right, well, he's influenced Bowie, yeah. You know, Eno, Roxy Music, Can, you know, Jonathan Richman. And I think, all right, so they, all those people, so that wouldn't be there. So like, what would it be like? You know, it just is impossible to sort of think, you know, the landscape would be completely different. But those first four albums, I just think they're the sort of text, aren't they, of contemporary left field music. So I was incredibly excited. They, you know, they meant so much to me, and I just felt really lucky to be there. And then, and then they just really didn't deliver. And I think it was down to a number of things. I mean, it was 7 o'clock at night, but it was summer, so it was really sunny. That just felt weird because you think, no, they're a nighttime band. They're clearly a nighttime band. And it just felt like four people on stage doing their own thing, really. And I was thinking they've either rehearsed too much or not enough. But the main thing was Lou Reed just clearly, I wouldn't say he didn't want to be there, but he wanted to be there on his own terms. And I know over the years he's always done things where he changes the cadence of lyrics. But every single song, he was basically singing a different melody. And you think, well, why are you doing these songs if you're not going to sing? And there was a couple of points where it gelled. They did a version of Waiting for the Man and also a couple of, I think, I Can't Stand It. And it suddenly gelled. You think, oh, yeah, this is it, this is great, this is why I want to be here. But a lot of time, it was like they were a tribute band to their own band. It was just, it was so flat. And I completely get that thing about not repeating yourself. But you think, well, that's the gig though, isn't it? You're here to do those songs. You know, and it's funny, isn't it? Because you get all keyed up and that, and sometimes it delivers, sometimes it doesn't. Whereas some of the best experiences of that is when you go in and the support band are on, you don't know who they are, you didn't even know what they're called, nothing. And you're suddenly blown away. You think, oh, God, who are they? You know, and then the it's a bit like the experience with Joy Division and Buzzcocks. You know, then the headline act come on, you think, yeah, they're pretty good, but your mind's still full of the support band. So I think the margin for disappointment with reformed bands is pretty wide.
Yeah, I tend to avoid myself. But you picked here Waiting for the Man from 1993. Is this a good one?
This is a really good one.
Yeah,
okay. They did a brilliant version of this at Glastonbury, and there's a really good version. This is from them live in Paris. And if it was all the good of this, I would be smiling like a woman in a toothpaste.
Thank you. everybody's been you, but nobody cares. You got the love tea, it gives you sweet taste. Then it's gonna slip, there's gonna no time to waste.
Wow, John Cale bashing it out there.
Yes, yeah, I love that. It reminds me of Mike Garson on Aladdin Sane. It's just that really, it's really alive and splashy. And yeah, it's like I say, if it could have all been as good as that, I would have been really happy. It's got that sort of that early feel of, like, you know, where they're still quite experimental. And because I think one of the great things about that first album is it's like, it's not a new sound, it's a mix of pre-existing sounds. So it's a little bit folk rock, it's a little bit the avant-garde, but it's just the mix, you know. And I think a lot of the music that advances stuff the most tends to be that, you know. There's very little things where you could say, oh, they did something completely new there. Usually it's about the blend, you know, what musicians have brought to their take on
it. Yeah, their music was incredibly varied when you just look at all the, you know, some of those really, really sweet, down-tempo, quiet, almost whispered songs. But, you know, very much, very definitively Velvet Underground.
Yeah, you know, they probably are the best band, if you're allowed to say something like that, you know, in terms of what they achieved. That first album was like a signpost in the late 60s, going, there's this direction, you know. And it's like, a lot of people didn't follow the sign to begin with, but it's like, couldn't have been more influential.
Well, the key people did, didn't they? So people like Bowie and Iggy certainly did. So, you know, they picked up where the Velvets left off.
Yeah, you know, and Jonathan Richmond and Eno, you know, and Can. Yeah, like I say, without them, it's really difficult to imagine what it would be like.
Now, one of the things your writing career has given you, Graham Duff, is the opportunity to bring some of your heroes into it. So when you did your ideal TV series with Johnny Vegas, you were able to bring in people like Marquis Smith and Paul Weller for cameo appearances.
Yeah.
I mean, they were quite happy to do it, were they? Well, who's this bloke and what's all this about?
I don't kid myself, and I'm sure it was Johnny's name that for a lot of people. Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, it's like you don't ask, you don't get, you know. And it's like the number of times where I've sort of thought, oh, I wonder if so-and-so, and people have said to me, they won't. And I always say, well, if I don't ask them, they definitely won't, you know. So I've been really fortunate. I think, you know, I don't know that anybody has turned it down, you know. And so, yeah, Barry Adamson and Marky Smith and Eleanor Palou from The Fall and John Robb. I'll be honest with you, and not everybody acquitted themselves as amazing actors, you know, but you know, for two lines, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. But it just gives it a different feel as well, you know. And, you know, I've probably been doing this for about 20 years, you know, making TV and radio things. But weirdly, most of my, you know, for want of a better phrase, most of my artistic friends tend to be musicians or artists rather than actors. I feel very close to that world, much more than I do to the world of acting somehow. I don't know why. I do still, even now, you know, a couple of decades down the line, I still slightly feel like if I'm doing TV stuff, that I'm behind enemy lines, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Is it a degree of imposter syndrome?
Yeah, definitely, you know, that somebody will find me out. And I think part of it is because I am largely doing things to sort of satisfy my own proclivities.
Yeah.
But that's not because I think this amazing person. I know that I'm not unique. You know, it's like, all right, my taste's rarefied in certain directions, but I know there's loads of people that, you know, I mean, you know, we're very different people. We've got a lot of stuff in common musically and our yeah. interests. So, you know, I know that if it appeals to me, then it'll appeal to a section of the populace, you know, but I just try not to let other people water it down. And I think that's part of what appeals to, you know, some of the musicians that I've worked with, as you know, in productions, is they can see that it's got I don't know, is it integrity? I'm not sure what it is, but it's got some purity to it, I suppose, you know, insofar as you can do when you're working for the BBC.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
The latter part of your book, a lot of people will recognise some familiar gigs and places if they've been knocking around in Brighton for a while. Mm-hmm. Quite a few of the gigs, I was at the same gigs as well.
Oh,
so
yes.
Sata Kinney at the Pavilion Theatre, The Strokes at The Lift.
Yeah.
Some fantastic names coming to Brighton, and you do you have the same kind of train spotterish detail for all of those as well, with, you know, set lists and how they did this and what they wore.
Yeah, well, I think, and that sort of, a few people have picked up that sort of what they wore thing, and I just think it is interesting that, because one of the early gigs I talked about is going to see the Two Tone tour in 1979, Madness Specials and Selector, and I remember standing in the queue outside, and this was end of October 1979, so the Two Tone thing had just exploded. I think the Specials single Gangsters come out in May, so it's still really early on, and there was a few people in the queue dressed in like Crombie's port by hats, but most people weren't, you know. And I was thinking back to it, and I was thinking, oh, there's a couple of women and a couple of girls in like charity shop 60s dresses, but most people were dressed in, you know, tank tops and jeans and things like that. And I was thinking, do you know what, if somebody had made a film now, absolutely everybody would be dressed in that two-tone style and stuff. And I just, it just was a bit of an indicator for me. I just think, no, it's worth thinking about what, you know, what things were like. And, you know, there's certain gigs where I'll just say, you know, this is the makeup of the audience. And there's one, like, going to see Bowie in, I think, 2002, and just that was so interesting, looking at the audience, because there's, you know, there was people of sort of our generation, and there was people like teens and 20s, and you think, God, they're just discovering Bowie for the first time. They've probably not even heard all his albums yet. I just think, I feel quite jealous of that, you know. And then there was literally, like, loads of people there who looked like they're out on an office party, you know, feather boas and spray, like it was a 70s themed night or something. And it was the most mixed audience I've ever seen. Yeah. And so you've got people, you know, Janine from Accounts who's come out, and then you've got some like incredibly ornate goths sitting, you know, next to them. So, yeah, I mean, Bowie is probably the ultimate example, I suppose, of somebody who just crosses all those boundaries.
Well, if you go for that long, you know, at some point you're going to do an album that hits a spot with someone at some point.
Yeah, true enough.
So you've been taking the book Foreground Music on tour. So it's doing a speaking tour. You're going to be in Brighton next week. How's it been going so far?
It's been really good fun, actually. And I was thinking that most of the people that came along would be sort of middle-aged bald men like me, but it hasn't been like that. It's been quite nice. It's been a real mix. So, yeah. And so I've been doing some readings and Q&As and stuff. And it's nice because it's that classic thing that happens. It's like, I finished this a while ago and it's sort of been sitting there and I've been working on other stuff. So it's nice now to go back and get a bit of a distance. And also to hear what chimes with people, because I discovered as a writer long ago, you can't always predict what's, you know, a lot of stuff I write is comedy, and sometimes we sit down and we do the read through, and gags that I don't even think are particularly jokes get a really big laugh. It's really gratifying. And then there's other things that I think, oh, this is the Benjamin, and people think, oh God, that was my big joke. So similarly with this, there's bits where people, oh, I really like this bit, or this made me think that, and you just can't tell how people are going to take it, you know. So it's been interesting, definitely.
But I guess there's something, because it's so varied, there's going to be something in it for you know, and a music fan who is passionate about music will get it. So you've got Psychic TV, you've got Massive Attack, Throbbing Gristle, and the punk stuff. So there's quite a variety of texts in there.
Well, I was conscious of you know, like yourself, my taste is quite broad, you know, and I think increasingly now there is less sort of tribalism in music, I think, than there used to be.
Yeah.
And I think part
of... It's postmodernism.
I think...
It's because you can listen to Spotify, you can listen, you know, to your parents' record collection, and you pick this or that out, and people can quite happily listen to Fleetwood Mac and not be offended by it.
Yeah, and I'm not having that.
No, I'm not having that either.
But, no, it's true, but I think because of digital culture, it's like... there's a sort of a levelling out that's happened, that something was recorded in 1962 can sound as bright and vital as something that was recorded 2 weeks ago, and they're just next to each other on a playlist. And I think, you know, that is probably a good thing, I think. There is less tribalism now, and I think there's people are more open to the range of stuff they'll listen to. And so that's what I was conscious of doing. And I think what's interesting is that originally your sort of tribalism would be amongst young people, you know, so when you're first sort of forming your identity and you choose which music and saying that this is me, this is my music, this is my sound, and I think that's less so amongst young people now, for the reasons we're saying, that they can access everything, and so a lot of people are obviously only interested in what's coming out right now because it's their sound, it's talking about their lives. But I'm really quite often impressed when I meet sort of, you know, people in their teens or early 20s, and their knowledge of music is really broad, because you can go out and find pretty much anything now, can't you?
Yep, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing. It is a good thing.
I'm going to finish off on Massive Attack, which it sounded like a huge gig, and a very interesting gig as well, because it was all cover versions.
Yeah, well, I've seen them a few times, but this was a particularly impressive gig. It was the Manchester International Festival in 2013, and it was with Adam Curtis, the documentary maker. And I didn't know what it was going to be, and I think most people didn't know what it was going to be. And I thought, oh, is it going to be a screening of a documentary and they're doing the soundtrack? And you just didn't, and in the end, we were in this enormous disused rail depot, and there was 14 screens all the way, so you were absolutely surrounded by cinema-sized screens, sometimes showing the same thing, sometimes showing different things. And then the screen at the end was like a gauze, so sometimes that would go opaque and you could see Massive Attack behind it. And so, yeah, it was all cover versions. I think it was because Adam Curtis just uses found footage for his documentary, so I think they were mirroring that. But the range, it was like, you know, so like Sugar Sugar by the Archies, and then Bela Lugosi's Dead, you know, or Dream Baby Dream, you know, or Just Like Honey. And it was like a real mixtape sort of aesthetic. It was really interesting because whatever it was they were doing, they were absolutely true to the spirit of it. So when they did Sugar Sugar, you sort of think, well, it's Massive Attack. Perhaps they're going to do loads of bottom end stuff or have a really dubby bit. But it was really light and bouncy, you know, and so 2 minutes long, because that was it. And then they did Bela Lugosi's Dead, and it was so dark and so gothic, you know. And I couldn't stand Bauhaus, I'll be honest with you, Bauhaus. I remember hearing that on John Peel and thinking, oh, this is interesting. And then Pete Murphy started singing, and I thought, oh, cheer up, love. I just thought it just seemed like sixth form poetry. And then Massive Attack did it, and Dee was just doing the vocal, like, really just plaintive, you know, and suddenly it was transformed. So, yeah, it was an incredible gig, and I've seen them a couple of times since, and they're still now doing stuff where they're screening some Adam Curtis stuff. I really admire them because I think, as you know, it's obvious that if they just tweak their sound a little bit, they could be, you know, in the top 10 all the time, you know, with really big-selling funky tunes. Because they've got that now, so they've got that ability. But 3D just doesn't want that. He wants to take it in another direction and do stuff that's more edgy. And I think if you go along to a Massive Attack concert and you want to hear Unfinished Sympathy and just, you know, have a dance around to some cool grooves, you're not going to get that. You're going to get bits of that, but you're going to get all sorts of other things as well. And I think it's really brave and really interesting. And also, what they do is so high quality. So even the stuff that isn't those dance groups, it's so beautifully put together. And I think they're a really special band. I always think it's interesting when bands don't mind confounding expectations, because so many bands are quite eager to please. And I think when you see bands like Massive Attack or The Fall or another example, where it's just like, you know, they're just taking it off to one side, and it's not up to you whether or not you want to follow, you know, and I like that.
Well, Graham Duff, very good luck with Foreground Music.
Thank you.
A Life in 15 Gigs. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I like the train spotterish elements as well.
I thought you might.
I do have a slightly musical train spotterish side to myself. But thank you for joining us on Radio Reverb.
A real pleasure, Melita.
And we'll finish off with Massive Attack.
Lovely.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Yes, honourable. Introducing the reggae legend himself, the one and only Mr. Horace Andy.
a fussing and fire. Hungry's a fussing and fire. All through the night. I've got two gates away from me. This is not a place for me to stay. Always a fussing fight. Always a fussing fight. All through the night. I've got two gates away from me. This is not a place for me to stay. Thank you.
This is Deborah.